Thank you very much. Enjoy being here today. I thought last night, when we celebrated Tom Glavine's career and honored him, actually yesterday afternoon we inducted him into the Hall of Fame, and last night we retired his number, a very rare tribute to a major league player, that was the greatest, most loving, understanding baseball environment I could possibly be in until I came here today. You folks really know your baseball. I'm really impressed by how much you know about the game of baseball, how much you care about it, how much you study it, and I'm totally impressed. I can't tell you how much I appreciate what you're doing. I'm delighted that you invited me. I'm delighted also, I admitted publicly for the first time that I might have tampered with an employee of another organization when I mentioned Paul Snyder and my appreciation and admiration for the work he was doing for the Braves while I was then general manager of the Kansas City Royals. At least I don't have to worry about tampering by talking nicely about Freddie Gonzalez today. Sadly, for the Marlins' viewpoint, I don't have to worry about it because he should still be managing that team, the great job he did. Freddie, nice to have you here today. I've had the great good pleasure of being with so many wonderful people over my 47 years in baseball. Roland Heeman, I mentioned before, is one of those. Paul Snyder, Freddie Gonzalez, Bobby Cox, and thousands more. I've had the great privilege. My accolades go to you award winners today for the work you've done in your research and writing and such. It's just remarkable. I've had the good pleasure of getting to know Ken Burns somewhat through my friendship and involvement with the Negro League Museum back in Kansas City, and Ken did a great tribute on that. And so those of you who earned those awards and various awards today, congratulations to you. There was one gentleman, though, who was honored for writing a book on the firing of umpires. Mark, you, where are you, Mark? You might want to do another chapter, Mark. After the imperfect game with the Detroit Tigers and the fair foul ball of the other night, I might feel a little bit more personally about that since it might have impacted the Eastern Division of the National League. You might want to think about writing another book. Or at least a follow-up. I've had a wonderful life in baseball. I'm so blessed. After 4 years of teaching as an 8th grade teacher in Baltimore County, having not reached my dream of being a professional baseball player, and advised by my then high school soccer coach, think about another career alternative just in case the scouts don't recognize your talent, John. So he convinced me that I should go to Towson State Teachers College, and I did, and I graduated, and I taught school for 4 years in Baltimore County. And one day, I was struck by my love and desire to be a part of the game of baseball in one way or another, as each of you have been. And I wrote a letter to Gerald Hufberger, the owner of the Baltimore Orioles, and it went on to Frank Cashin, the president, and Harry Dalton, the general manager, and Lou Berman, the director of player development, and I was interviewed and I was hired. And in 1966, I began my career in baseball. There was another school teacher, sadly, Krista McAuliffe, who you may remember was the first teacher astronaut and sadly lost her life when that spacecraft exploded. And it was written about her that she was the first teacher to leave planet Earth to go on exploration. I will say to you that I was the first teacher whose feet left the ground when I learned that I was hired by the Baltimore Orioles, and they've not touched down since. So I'm really thrilled by that. I spent my years in Baltimore, and then I went to Kansas City with a remarkable opportunity to be a part of building an expansion franchise. Now, the title of my talk today was going to be Stats Don't Lie, and I'll tell you why I said that and why I chose that as my title. In Kansas City, I started out as the young boy in the office, as I was in Baltimore. I was now the young boy in the office in Kansas City instead of Baltimore. and I worked for great, great baseball people, and I had the opportunity to learn and to grow and to do research and to pay attention to statistics and to analyze statistics and to make analyses and evaluations. And as a result of all of those things and apparently coming to the right conclusions more often than not, I was promoted up the line and ultimately became general manager. And in 1981, at the very young age then of 40 years of age, I became general manager. In fact, I was the youngest general manager in baseball at age 40 in 1981. Today, if you're a general manager at age 40, you're on your way out the door, because these 26-year-old guys who are coming in with all this knowledge of baseball statistics and baseball information and all that are ready to take over from the time they step out of college. But at age 40 in 1981, I became a general manager. And what I did, and have done all of my life, and Paul will tell you, is to try to combine, or always combine, the value of statistical evaluation and statistical study and statistical analysis with the great analytical and instinctive evaluation skills of scouts. I believe that that is the combination. There's no good general manager who's ever worked in this business, who's ever made a deal, a good one, a bad one, who did not use that combination of analysis to do their jobs and do them well. I defy anyone who says that any good general manager has never used statistics effectively. I always did. I tried to use them effectively, but I also listened to Paul Snyder, and I also listened to Tom Ferrick, and it was Tom Ferrick. You may know, some of you may, I'm sure most of you do know, who Tom Ferrick was, a venerable old veteran scout who was working with me, and as the young general manager, when I could turn with great confidence to the wisdom and the analyses and the instincts of Tom Ferrick, who, with all that scouting experience, would say to me, John, remember this, stats don't lie. It just makes the point. You cannot exist, you cannot succeed, you cannot work, you cannot have any hope for complete and ultimate success, a world championship, or 14 consecutive division championships as we enjoyed here in Atlanta, a remarkable feat which, by the way, I think will never, ever be matched in any sport. The way professional athletes are dealt with today, the way the environment in professional sports exists, difficult to have that kind of consistency. But to have someone like Tom Ferrick, a great and well-respected scout, say to me, stats don't lie. Look at the back of this guy's baseball card. And that's what he showed me. We were making a deal, and we were contemplating one player versus another. And Tom turns to me and said, John, stats don't lie. Always rely on statistics. Well, I have all of my life, but I also have relied on Paul Snyder's instincts and the instincts of Rosie Gilhausen and the instincts of Jim Fregosi and people who I would ask their opinion and I would weigh it and measure it and ultimately get to the point where I could make a decision based on the consensus of intelligence and evaluation and analysis and statistical review and ultimately make the choice that, for the most part, turned out well. Now, okay, I did trade Adam Wainwright. I did do that. But we also made a trade for Freddie McGriff. After we went from worst to first in 1991, those great start, the great start of our wonderful years here in Atlanta, the team had not yet established itself, but in the pipeline, thanks to Paul Snyder and Bobby Cox, then the general manager, and the support of President Stan Kasten, the process had begun. The building through scouting and player development, the lifeblood of any good baseball organization, from my view, the building had begun. And in Kansas City, as I was evaluating the opportunity, whether or not I should take the opportunity to become the general manager of the Atlanta Braves, after having worked for 9 years with the Kansas City Royals, we were viewed as the IBM of the American League, conservative, rock solid, certain in their decisions, good in their decision making, consistent in their approach to the game, strong scouting and player development, the dynamic and outside the box thinking of the Royals Baseball Academy, which Ewing Kauffman started to find baseball players, make baseball players out of athletes, didn't work, but it was outside the box thinking. But that working for that organization and to even contemplate making a move as dramatic as it was for me personally and professionally to come to the Atlanta Braves. But I felt in my heart, this community and this organization was one just ready to be primed to have success. If the right management plan, if the right leadership plan were put in place, I thought they could have success. Well, I believed I could supply that. And knowing that people like Paul Snyder and Bobby Cox still had their hands involved in this franchise, it was easy for me to come here and help to lead this organization to this ultimate decade plus of success that we enjoyed. From worst to first in 1991, we became the outdoor world champions in 1991. Of course, we played the Minnesota Twins in the World Series in 1991. They won all of their home games indoors, and we won all of our home games outdoors. Sadly, they had four games, we had three. They became world champions, we were the outdoor world champions, but that was the start. That was, and we awakened not only in Atlanta, but in the southeastern United States and all around the United States, people's interest in baseball in Atlanta. Who are these Atlanta Braves? What kind of a blend did they create? How in the world did they do that? Well, how did they do that? They had a pipeline filled with Tom Glavins and John Smoltz and Steve Avery and on and on and on, and Ronnie Gannon and David Justice and Javi Lopez and Chipper Jones. They were in the pipeline. They were young, talented players, but they didn't have veteran leadership, people who could show them the way. So as general manager, what I thought was most important, and Paul and I talked about this, and Bobby Cox and I talked about this, we needed to provide veteran leadership and create a blend of veteran and young players, talented, all. But when Terry Pendleton was signed, and I know Furman Fisher was here earlier today, Furman said I was the dumbest general manager in the history of mankind for signing Terry Pendleton as a free agent in the winter of 1990. He's since apologized to me. We then signed Sid Bream as a free agent. We then signed Rafael Belliard, shortstop, as a free agent. And in spring training that year with the Montreal Expos, we made a trade for Otis Nixon. Now, what does that do? It creates the finest defensive matrix behind these great young pitchers and provides veteran leadership. And the blend of that group went from worst to first. I'll never forget, on one of the backfields, Paul, in West Palm Beach, I think we called it Iwo Jima because that's how far it seemed away from the normal workout facility. I'm standing by the batting cage and Terry Pendleton motions to me to come over. We had just signed Terry as that free agent. He said, John, we're going to have some fun here this year. This is a very talented bunch. Watch what we can do. Well, Terry was right. He was right in his projections. We won. We went from worst to first. We played the Minnesota Twins, but it wasn't just a win in 1991, because again, as you know, in 1992, we played the Toronto Blue Jays in the World Series. And we needed a relief pitcher towards the end of the year, and so we ended up picking up Jeff Reardon, the great split-fingered fastball guy who dominated as a closer for many, many years, and we had him on our team. And in the World Series, in this particular circumstance, Jeff Reardon's on the mound, and to the plate comes raw rookie Ed Sprague. Most raw rookies come off the bench, as Freddie knows, swinging from their butts at whatever's thrown to the plate. And this guy had one of the best split-finger pitches in the world. Had he thrown that three times, Sprague would have likely swung and missed. He threw him a fastball on the first pitch, and it went out of the park. And so did our dreams in 1992. The Toronto Blue Jays beat us. But we kept that string alive, and we won again in 93. And sadly, no one won in 94 because all of baseball lost. All of baseball went dark. We had no World Series. But I like to tell people and remind them, if you look what the Braves were doing before we turned out the lights on the season that year, we were on an ascent. And the Montreal Expos, who were ahead of us then, were looking over their shoulder. We would have caught them. But in the completed seasons, 14 consecutive completed seasons, we won our division, and we appeared in those postseasons. In 1995, of course, we reached the glory land. I'll never forget that day as long as I live. It was our world championship. We finally put that group together through good scouting and wonderful player development and good major league trades and good major league scouting and the support of a great ownership and everyone working together and pulling together with the same kind of vigor, the same kind of creativity, and the same kind of commitment. We won in 1995 and we became world champions, the first and only, so far, world championship professional team ever for the city of Atlanta, Georgia. We could have had more. We could have had one in 91. We could have had one in 92. We win in 95. We come out of New York City in 1996 with young Andrew Jones hitting two home runs in the first two games. We're ahead 2-0. We've got the Yankees right where we want them. It didn't happen. I can remember like it was yesterday after we come back to town with a 2-0 lead. We're leading this game 6-0. I think it was the fourth game. Denny Nagel's pitching. All of a sudden, the Yankees climb back in it. Mark Wohlers, our great relief pitcher, who saved so many games for us, comes into the game, and he's got a dynamic fastball. Got a dynamic fastball, and this guy named Jim Larritz is at the plate. You guys know Jim Larritz. He's had his troubles now, but at the time, he was a real good player, a real reliable player. Mark Wohlers throws slider one. This is a guy with a 98-99 mile an hour fastball. Larritz is right on it, fouls it back. Slider two, fouls it back. The bat heads right out here with a lot of speed. Slider three, remember that one, Paul? Over the fence it went. You know the cartoon they show sometimes on television where they show the baseball being hit so hard, its eyes are wide open, its tongue is hanging? That's how that baseball looked going out of the stadium. I remember those times. I remember those days. But having an opportunity to enjoy those years, now in my 47th, and to experience what we've experienced here, and to have the great and glorious opportunity to work with you and Kauffman and the wonderful people building that expansion franchise. They've struggled mightily. And those of you, anybody here from Kansas City or the Midwestern region, that franchise has struggled mightily in the last 15 years or so, or 17 years, because they've taken their eye off the ball. They forgot about the cornerstone of success, the lifeblood of success in every baseball organization, scouting and player development. The Yankees even forgot about it for a while, for their about 10-year dip, when they decided to sign everybody's high-paid free agent and tried to amass all of the high-priced players and figure, now they're doing it again, but they can afford it now, $220 million payroll, you can have an all-star at every position. But nevertheless, I digress. Back in those days, still scouting and player development was the cornerstone, was the lifeblood, was the secret potion to succeeding with continuity, with continuum. Not just a short spurt to the top and then a dynamic and dramatic drop to the bottom, but a continuum of success. And that's what we tried to create here in Atlanta, and I think we've done that, despite the fact that you may say, and you know, and you're right, we have not been for the past 4 years in postseason play. I'm reminded of that from time to time. But we were in it every year from 1991 until that four-year period began, and we're climbing back in it again this year, although we went from a 7-game lead to now, this bright morning, only a 1-game lead. But I believe we have a team that can do it again. Baseball economics. One of the things that impacts the opportunity for organizations to build and sustain themselves is how they can manage baseball economics. If you have good scouting and good player development and really big saddlebags full of lots of money, that's a wonderful combination. Most of us don't have that. Most of us have either good scouting and player development, and that's where we focus our energy and our intellect and our commitment, because that's how you build teams without having the biggest saddlebags with the most money. And in those rare occasions when somebody wakes up and has this sort of epiphany, wait a second, you can really develop players and find players by scouting and player development like the Boston Red Sox now have done and the Yankees are now doing, that is really the optimum of building a major league team and continuing to build a major league team. But those of us who don't have all the money in the world to spend can still do it. And the Tampa Bay Devil Rays have proven it. The Minnesota Twins proven it over the years. We've proven it over the years. You can still build good winning teams, even in the face of the challenges of baseball economics. If you have better scouting, not just good scouting, but better scouting and better player development, you can challenge those clubs for the World Championship. And we've done that. We've done that. Building an organization, any organization, I believe, not just a baseball organization, relies on one principal ingredient. I've always believed that, and that's people. Sure, you have to have a vision. You have to provide, and we've talked about this, we began talking in the winter of 1990. What is the vision for the Atlanta Braves? You have to have precise goals. What is the goal for the Atlanta Braves? Well, the winter of 1990, it was not to get better, not to work harder, not to be more intense, not a nebulous stuff. Our goal was what, Paul? To win a world championship, to become a world championship organization and to sustain it. Thank God we've done that. The commissioner now refers to the Atlanta Braves as the gold standard organization in baseball, not only because we consistently put teams on the field that represent us well and in championship fashion, but because our organization operates in that way. But your goals have to be clear and they have to be precise. You might have heard the story about the London Transit Authority, who had a lot of problems the last couple of years. They were getting nasty letters from a lot of their customers as the buses went flying by and wouldn't stop on the corners to pick up. There were people were missing their appointments, they were late to their destinations, and finally, after so many angry letters to the London Transit Authority, they finally made a statement. They said this: "It is impossible for us to live up to our precise schedule if we must constantly stop to pick up passengers." True story. True story. Not a good goal. Not a real clear goal. They were wrong. I believe in hiring good people as the key ingredient. Empowering them, motivating them, honoring them, giving them an opportunity to work and to contribute to your success. Motivate them. Give them hope for progress. We can all do better. Everybody can get better at what they're doing. You remember the name Pablo Casals? Wasn't a tennis player. He wasn't an infielder for some minor league team. The greatest cellist who ever lived, who when he was over 90 years old, was interviewed by a young reporter who came to him and said, "Mr. Casals, you're the greatest cellist who ever lived, yet you practice your instrument 6 hours every day. Why is that?" And simply Casals turned and said, "Because I believe I am making progress." Can't we all make progress? So if we encourage our people to do that, and we constantly do that. And you have to have enthusiasm for what you do. And nothing better sample enthusiasm for me than two things that I saw in my career as a young baseball executive, traveling from Bluefield, West Virginia, in the Appalachian League with the Baltimore Orioles, all over the country. And while in Bluefield one day, watching a bunch of young kids just out of high school and college play a game, it was a bunt situation for sure. Everyone knew he was going to bunt. Both teams knew the guy was going to bunt. The lady taking tickets knew it. The popcorn salesman knew it. Pitch is made to home plate. The guy squares around, bunts the ball down the first baseline. In anticipation of this play, the kid goes over and catches the ball between home and first and stands in the baseline with the ball. Now, these are kids who are just 2 weeks together playing professional baseball. The runner looks up and sees the pitcher standing there with the ball, and he stops. And the pitcher, instead of turning and throwing the ball to the second baseman, who's now standing on first, instead runs back to try to tag the hitter out. The hitter stops and runs back towards home plate. And they get even a rundown halfway between home plate and first base. The kid to avoid the tag dove back into home plate. And he was tagged out. And the umpire said, "You're out." So I came back to Lou Gorman, who was my boss in Baltimore, and I said, "Lou, what would have happened if the umpire had called him safe? Minus one run, but you're coming in from the wrong way." So I'm in Corning, New York. I'm now with Kansas City. I'm in Corning, New York, New York Penn League, watching a play. Tying runs at second base. Our team's in the field. Tying runs at second base. Boom, guy hits a line drive. Guy comes speeding around third base. The center fielder comes in, fields the ball cleanly. Crow hop, boom. One hop throw to home plate to the catcher. Here comes the runner sliding in. Here comes the ball at the very same time. Cloud of dust. Umpire stands like this. Runner gets up and runs to the bench. Sits down. The manager of our team says, "Go tagging. He didn't touch home plate." Now the kid looks over and sees 25 guys he's never seen in his life. These guys just reported for play a couple of weeks ago himself, and runs to the bench and starts tagging the last guy on the bench on the leg. The kid who was running is sitting next to the manager, who throws catapulting out of the dugout, and they got this kid in a rundown between the dugout and home plate. Nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm. Well, these kids had enthusiasm. I've spent 47 years in baseball, 26 of those as a general manager, now 4 as a president. But I always have scouted. I have always analyzed. From the time I can remember loving baseball at age 5, my dad played in minor leagues for 3 years, and he introduced me to the game when I was a kid in Baltimore. From the time I played against other kids and from the time I grew in my ability and my accomplishments, I always evaluated other players. And I did that all of my life. And to have the good fortune to be called to a profession and a job that allowed me to do that for a living and to be fairly good at it, thanks to the people who were around me who I listened to always. I'll tell you a story about listening. When I was 5 years old, 1945, had the measles and I had a very high temperature and I lost the hearing in my right ear. I'm stone deaf in my right ear. And they said in those days, parents didn't take their kids to the hospital when their temperatures got up to 103 or 104. You just put ice bags on their head and pat them on the head and say, hang in there, you know, hang in it. Didn't run them off to the hospital. So I lost my hearing. They say it's a wonder that I didn't lose hearing in both the ears, because that was what happened in those days, or that I didn't suffer brain damage. Jury's still out on that part, but I only lost hearing in one ear. But what happened in 1945 is that I learned how to listen. I learned how to listen very, very attentively. I watched people talk. I watched them think. I watched them form their thoughts. I listened to teachers that way, and I listened to scouts that way, and I listened to smart people that way. And that's the way I've learned. That's the way I've become, however good I've become. That's how it's happened. I've been blessed to be around a lot of good, smart people, hardworking people who I've listened to. And that's a key to my success. And as a leader, and as a management representative, and if you are any company that you run, communication then becomes so essential, because you are the spokesman. You are imparting to the people you're working with, your constituents, your allies, your partners, how important things are. And I used to tell my son and my daughter, and my son now is 30 years old, who just retired as a player, now working for us as a minor league roving infield instructor. I said, remember this, your communication is your personal advertisement. For every time you open your mouth, you allow others to look into your mind. It's really the second way that people make an impression of who you are. If you represent your organization, dress well, present yourself well, and then speak well. Express yourself properly. You're representing the Atlanta Braves, the great gold standard organization. Be proud of that, represent that, dignify that in how you look and how you work and how you talk. And that's what we've done here. That's what we've done here for these past 20 years. We're going to continue to do that as long as I have anything to say about it. I thank you for the opportunity to be with you today. I love my work, and I love being with so many people who love baseball. Thank you so very, very much.